Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Harris. This is actually my first day in office as the director of the LSE Asia Research Centre, and so it gives me particular pleasure that that today I can be first to welcome His Excellency Kamlesh Sharma, High Commissioner of India, who will be speaking to us tonight on the subject of India in the globalizing world. His Excellency Mr. Kamlesh Sharma actually started out in life as an academic, having been a lecturer in English in Delhi University, but he gave up English literature and the university a good many years ago for his career in diplomacy, having been a member of the Indian Foreign Service since 1965. In his period of service as a diplomat, he's done a number of very interesting jobs, taken on a number of very interesting roles. Quite recently was special representative of the Secretary General of the UN to East Timor as Under Secretary General. He's also been the permanent representative of India to the United Nations in Geneva, including being ambassador for disarmament and spokesman for developing countries in the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, and he was for 5 years permanent representative of India to the United Nations in New York. Mr. Sharma has a very diverse range of interests, which are partly reflected in books that he has edited, which include a collection, Mille Fleurs, Poetry from Around the World, but also a book, Imagining Tomorrow, Rethinking the Global Challenge, which is much closer to his subject for tonight, which is India in a Globalizing World. Before I invite His Excellency to speak, I'd just like to say that his remarks tonight are off the record. This evening, I think, Chatham House rules apply. Sir.
Thank you very much, Professor Harris. When you were reading out my past accomplishments in my career, I was reminded of a session which I had chaired when I was a fellow at Harvard University, and I felt a hand creep up to my arm and hold it firmly and whispered in my ear, "That's enough, Ambassador, it's now beginning to sound like an obituary." Since I am retired, you know, sometimes I feel that's the same way, but I hope too many expectations are not aroused as a result of the background which you've given. It does remind me, though, recently of a wonderful quote I saw of a person who turned 100 years old. And he was asked whether he would like to make any statement on this occasion. And he said, "Yes, you know, if I had known that I'm going to live to be 100 years, I would have taken much better care of myself." Well, when I was coming here, I thought perhaps I should have prepared myself better for this formidable audience. Last time when I spoke here, in fact, I had promised that I'll have a PowerPoint presentation. Well, I don't. What I do have are elements of it. I'm still working on it. It's harder work than I thought. But you'll see glimpses of what I'm working on. Why am I here? Why am I speaking on India and the globalizing world? Well, because we've heard of countries being a flavor of the year or the flavor of the decade, but it's quite unique, I think, to hear of countries being the flavor of the century. And recently you may have heard of the Goldman Sachs BRICS report, which said that by the year 2040, no great catastrophe taking place. India should be the third largest economy in the world after China and the US. And then there was another National Intelligence Council, the NIC report, which had a mapping of the future, which had three or four scenarios. And in each scenario, no matter what the given was fed, into their exercise, they found that India was central to the main actors, globally speaking. And recently, if you picked up The Economist, you would have found India and China. I think Martin Wolf did a 3-whole-page report in Financial Times, India and China. So, you know, where India and China are headed, in what way is the world reshaping itself? These are becoming very large questions, and people are more interested in hearing what the Indian High Commissioner has to say than has traditionally been the case in London. What is the perspective in which I can talk? Well, one can be, how well has India done since it started liberalizing? This is very convenient, because China started liberalizing in 1978. India started it in 1991. Deng Xiaoping first said, farmers, you can keep half your produce and do what you like with it. It's no sin to be rich. A few years later, he says you can invest as much as you like in the Pearl River Delta. And people in Hong Kong knew what was coming. So they took advantage of it, and that's how this great miracle of the Eastern Seaboard started. So they had 13-year advantage on India. We started in 1991. This is very convenient, because no matter how much time lapses, we will always have that 13-year lead to show that we can do more in the next decade. Another one is the colonial context, which is, it is pretty much demonstrated that in the year 1800, China and India had half of the world's produce. And by the year 1900, it has come down to the middle digits, 6%, 7-8%, something like that. So in a century, the decline had been absolutely catastrophic. And from 1900 onwards, a little bit after independence, India and China are interesting studies, because we are 5,000 years, give a round figure, old civilizations, but 50 years old as modern states. So you can say, yes, well, you can take that comparison, that actually we are trying to recover what we were 200 years ago. And that's not unfair. That's a reasonable goal. So we extend the perspective a little further. But you can go further, deeper still, and you can say that why not start when India really had the intellectual capital of the world and had the lead in it? If you go to the New York Museum of Natural History, you'll see a plaque per civilization. It's about 50 seconds of reading time, which they think is the average attention span of your visitor to that museum, I think, per civilization. And when it comes to India, they say that it was the first country, is the country which people which invented the zero and the decimal system and the exact value of pi 1,500 years ago before anyone else attempted it in close away. The first country about 1,000 years before Galileo, Copernicus, anyone else, is a treatise which says that the Earth moves around its axis and revolves around the sun, and theory of seasons and all that. It is there, it narrated first intervention in surgery, and so on. You can do that as well. Now, whichever way you adopt, you have to come up with an answer. But I think all three are appropriate, because what is driving Indian reform sentiment today is all three. A kind of a desperation to catch up, of seeing models around you, what people have achieved, and therefore a kind of sense of extreme urgency. Then recovering what you had lost in the colonial era, not the colonial era, 1,000 years. Morgan Stanley has a rather remarkable report in India, which, unusually for these kind of investment bankers, takes a very large cultural view of where India was and where it has come. And he says, well, India can also be seen as the country which gave you the zero, as the country which has the most sophisticated ancient language. The first recorded utterance of mankind is in Sanskrit, which has an ancient system of healthcare, which is Ayurveda and which is yoga. I was in the Ashmolean Museum and I saw two very remarkable seals. One was something which looks like a unicorn but is not. It is from 2000 BC on the river civilizations of India. The remarkable thing is it was discovered in the Euphrates or the Tigris. So trade in 2000 BC. And there was another seal 2000 BC which showed a yogi you know, in a yogic posture, perfect yogic posture, finely chiseled piece, also 2000 BC. So the point was being made that you can have, the point I'd like to make is you can recover, or you can gain, you can have gains which are seen only in terms of indicators, which people understand, the Wall Street understands. You can have gains which the nation understands, which is recovery of your past role in the world. You can also have gains which the world understands as a civilization coming into its own. And this is, I think, a rather important point, because someone else has made it, because what the world has never seen is an ancient civilization at the dawn of history recovering, reviving, and reinvigorating itself. And it's happening both in respect to China and India. It has never happened before in history. And it's important to recall this, because some of the questions of how is it that when we look at India doing well, we have a trajectory which places it here. But when we study where India is, it is somewhere in a very different place. So the resources which it is drawing upon are obviously not only the economic indicators, but a very deep software as well. I'd like to run through some of the main features of the Indian situation today. Growth, the famous Hindu rate of growth used to be 3.5%. In the 80s, it became around 5. Now it is around 7. The point about Indian growth is that it's not a roller coaster ride. Once you make a gain, it pretty much stays put. There are very few negative blips. It just keeps on in mounting. So your fundamentals, in some way, are not oscillating. Your achievements are lasting. Trade is very important because we had an introspective economic policy, a defensive policy of tariff walls, an autarkic policy to begin with. It was as much economic policy as post-colonial political and cultural policy. Sit on the family silver. Don't let it go. That was the colonial experience in our mind. So within that policy, trade did, people used to say Korea is doing well because it has export led growth. India's trade figures are not startling because India does not have a growth policy which is export led. Of course, people are now asking why not? What was wrong with having an export led growth policy? Now we're asking the right questions and we're saying no, trade is going to be central to it. So now you have 24% of the GDP is now trade, which used to be a very small amount to begin with. So this is something very new. In agriculture, it is one of the most undervalued assets in India. China is the largest grower of fruits. China is the largest grower in the world of vegetables. China has about 60 to 65% of the arable land India has. India has much more arable land than China has. Once we had the Green Revolution, we declared victory, we can feed ourselves, we don't need to do any more. Once again, as in trade, we didn't ask the follow-up question. If you can, with the north of India, a little bit of revolution there, feed the whole country, why aren't you trying to replicate this evolution all over the country and try and be the breadbasket of the world or whatever, be a major exporter of every kind of agricultural produce? Well, partly because of the rural country vote and partly because our Prime Minister is an economist. He's been the permanent undersecretary in the Ministry of in the Treasury. He's been the finance minister. He's been head of the South Commission in Geneva. He is a very, very coherent thinker in economic terms. And he's very clear on the point. On this point, that agriculture, which used to grow at 4%, has slipped down to almost half the growth rate, has to be pulled up. And if you don't do that, you can't have the first target which we have, which is of 8% growth rate. And this can only be done by inviting corporations, and this has started already, by improving the infrastructure, by allowing import of capital goods free of customs if you are doing, importing seeds if that's what you want, and investing in the kind of crop you want in an environment where the size of the plot is very small. In terms of hectares, average is really around 2 or something. So you can grow, you can have a policy on small plots of producing cash crops, high value crops, which are then taken by the corporate world, which processes it, and everyone is a winner in this. So for the first time, we have a policy in agriculture which is linked as it were, to the global economy and integrating with the global economy. In manufacturers, it is sometimes said offhand, China for manufacturers, India for services. But this would be very glib. It would be glib both ways. Because one of the remarkable things, and an untold story about India, everyone knows about services in India, outsourcing, offshoring, knowledge economy, R&D centers and so on, but people think manufacturers are doing badly in India, but this is not the case. Because once we started liberalizing, the manufacturing sector in India over the last few years has modernized itself and made it globally competitive. It has been growing at the rate of 6.4% between 91 and 2004. And now we have clusters of manufacturing excellence in automobiles, in glass, in automotive components, in electrical, electronic products, pharmaceutical, specialty chemicals, and we are beginning also to, in our management, in our productivity practices, in our manufacturing industry, to globalize ourselves. So we have become a supplier to marquee global customers now. We've moved away from the contrived system, which we had earlier, into a competitive system, which has undertaken comprehensive restructuring, allowing massive cost rationalization, shedding of unprofitable businesses, initiatives to improve efficiencies in areas of operations, technology, and product development, and unlocking human resource capabilities to effect productivity improvements. I'm reading from somebody, a management guru, who has made the statement about India and goes on to say many more things, that India will be a force in manufacturing in the time to come. As far as the services is concerned, this is not something I need to dwell upon, because this has been a very dramatic demonstration by India, particularly in the ICT, and we feel that in the ICT, we hope to be able to have sales of $80 billion by the year 2008. And here also, what people have said about what India has done in the services field is common knowledge and is read everywhere. The last area, which is a futuristic area, is the knowledge economy. This is in the cluster science, innovation, and technology. In fact, we have a working group here. We have a bilateral working group with UK on innovation and technology. And this means research and development capabilities, how to apply emerging technologies and create spin-off companies, and how to have intellectual capital-based companies in the future coming up in India. Many countries have realized this. America, for instance, over the last 10 years, has any number of R&D centers, and I read a startling statistic recently that over this period, about 1,000 patents from these completely owned R&D centers have been registered with the Copyright and Patent Authority in the US. The global information networks, which are now intrinsic to Indian operations, have given us techniques and specialties where it is very difficult now, progressively, if you want to have a global package, not to factor in the Indian competitive advantage. There are many challenges ahead, with managing increasing complexity, handling employees, intensive competition and turnover, other locations coming up in the world, backlash against outsourcing, hysteria about industrial hollowing out, pressure which can be expected, protectionist measures and so on. But we feel that there are also countervailing trends which will make sure that these advantages in India are preserved. And these are fiercer global competition, bigger commercial risks which companies have to take, faster innovation that is required, shorter product cycles, shortages of key staff in northern markets, and all of these are transforming the methods of doing business globally. And we feel that in the end, the Indian advantage is going to prevail. Now, these are the main areas in which the whole spectrum of an economy displays itself. Traditional exports, of course, always there, which are rising in the case of India. Trade, agriculture, manufacture, services, and the knowledge economy. And India is poised to do well in all of them. Some of the comments, particularly in the R&D sector, are interesting, and I'd just like to recite two here. This is from Jack Welch, CEO, General Electric. A truly global company will be one that uses the intellect and resources of every corner of the world. India is a developed country as far as intellectual capital is concerned. And then by the president of Motorola, a technology company would fail in its IQ if it did not have anything significant in India. There is quality, there is speed, there is process orientation in this country. The productivity indicators in India are turning to be very positive. This is the quality of human capital, the rate of capital accumulation, output of the labor force, efficiency with which resources are used, and speed with which technology and other forms of know-how are transferred and ingested from the more advanced countries. Some of the indicators are worth mentioning here. A moving average of the previous 10 years' household savings has risen from 7% of GDP in 59-60 to more than 20% by the turn of the century. Private corporate savings have also risen from below 2% of GDP in the 10 years to 1991 to 4%, even though the public savings rate has deteriorated sharply because of the fiscal deficit. The overall gross domestic savings rate has risen to a 10-year moving average of 24% against 10% in the years up to 59 and 60. The actual savings rate in 2003 and 4 was 28% of GDP. The overall rate of investment has risen with the savings rate from an average of 12% of GDP in the 10 years up to 1960 to close to 25% in the latest period. The return on capital, which is the investment rate ratio to the growth rate, or the ICOR, has been increasing too. All of this is very conveniently given in Martin Wolf's article in the Financial Times on the statistics in India. There are areas like banking reforms, areas like air services, which indicate the way the economy is moving and the way the blending of the Indian economy with the global economy is taking place. Air services with the US is now open skies. With the UK, it is almost open skies. In our mission, we are giving 25% more visas every year to travelers to India, and it's true, it's even more true of travelers coming from India to the UK. The reserves which we have been steadily rising week to week. It now stands at about 142 billion. Acquisitions abroad, as a way of reverse traffic, have been going up steadily. It was 28 3 years ago. It became about 45 a year ago. And last year, it was about 60. We feel that the Indian economic advantage is going to come in the following areas. Pharmaceuticals. And there was in Chatham House recently a meeting in which all of these advantages, about a dozen of them, were demonstrated. Molecule development, clinical testing, and drug development processes, testing of drugs, and so on. In banking technology, there was recently a survey done of which are the 10 leading companies in the world offering software in the most modern banking technology. Four of these companies were Indian companies. Now, this is an interesting data because Indian banking cannot yet to be said to belong in the same league. But obviously, the technology which we require to get there has already been developed. This is also the reason why so many of the Indian companies are now getting contracts and expanding their business, it's not because they are the sweatshops of the world and they're giving you a cost advantage. It is simply because their delivery and efficiency is exceptional. I think they call it Comprehensive Maturity Model 5. Another world of saying it is Sigma Black Belters, which means the highest standard which you have, the majority of the companies that have the highest standards are Indian companies. Offshore solution centers across a wide front. I read recently that publishing houses are now having their things edited, copy edited in India. Any kind of most companies who want to redesign their efficiency and cost paradigms will always find a component in which they can find a solution center in India to give that advantage to them. The financial services industry, interestingly, same as in banking, it's very advanced. Customer interaction services of a variety of nature. Services outsourcing. Biotechnology. Biotechnology is an interesting field because it has come up recently, really, in the last few years. And we already have one company with a turnover of more than $1 billion. And interestingly, in the life sciences, as in the UK, it's women who are extremely prominent there. And we feel that we have the strength in chemistry, in bioinformatics, and all that it takes in order to have state of art biotechnology. And making India into a global R&D hub. All of these are what someone described as parts of the Indian economic advantage. If you are a major corporation, or even if you are not a major corporation, but a technology company, increasingly you will have to look at what is the advantage you can derive from the international division of labor, which is being reoriented and recast. And the capacities in India, together with other countries, will increasingly become a component of this. I should say something about the hurdles ahead as well, very briefly. This is yet another slide in my PowerPoint presentation. I'll just go through it because in case you think that I've now entered the stratosphere, I'd like to bring myself down to earth. I've said that India has underlying fundamentals that are extremely strong, which is why some of the achievements which I mentioned are possible. But if I recount the hurdles ahead, they really are a very tough and a long road ahead. One is infrastructure. Some areas of infrastructure have done very well, such as telecommunications. In some of them, the policies are quite advanced, like in ports, and also civil aviation. Some are slower to show results, such as power. We have a strong policy in roads. But the point is that if your transaction costs continue to suffer because of your bad infrastructure, then people have said that India doesn't have to do anything more than fix its infrastructure and you could have a growth gain of 1% to 2%. Second is lifting the rural structure. We cannot have a society which is traveling, which lives in two universes. You simply have to have a policy of overcoming the digital divide, and all of these elements are also now being very consciously worked upon, from rural roads to how to use the digital innovation and the telecom innovations to lift the countryside, including agricultural policy. The fiscal deficit is not growing, but is very stubborn. At about 10% of GDP, it is quite high. The social infrastructure, above all, which is health, child mortality, education, maternal mortality, is an imperative and central to anything which you can call a social gain. As against a political gain of democracy or an economic gain, you have to have coherence between how well your society is doing, how well your politics is doing, and how well your economy is doing. It's impossible to say that any two of these are doing well, but the third one is not. And the social infrastructure is something which has fallen quite behind, although in the tertiary infrastructure, India has surged ahead. the rationalization of the system of indirect taxation. This is another element. I'm told if you rationalize it through VAT and harmonization of central and state taxes, you can have an efficiency gain in growth of yet another 1%. Stepping up the FDI. FDIs are currently at about $4 to $5 billion, whereas portfolio investment is at $11 billion. The stock markets in India are one of the brighter chapters in our modernization program. A lot of money is coming in portfolio investment, but the FDI is moving only gradually. Progressive reduction in tariff levels. We've done extremely well in the last few years, and the last budget brought the non-farm sector down to 15%. But we have to make it single digit, and our aim is to make it ASEAN levels. Above all, increasing position in global competitiveness rankings. Although we have high productivity gains, obviously in the indicator which is used in this index of global competitiveness, you are losing ground. India is down from 38th to 40th position. China has moved up from 39th to 24th. Obviously, there are some productivity gains which India has because despite the fact that investment in China and FDI is so heavy compared to what takes place in India, the rate of growth of the two economies are not that far apart. But at the same time, there are other indicators which show that you have a long way to go. Reforming bureaucracy is understood. It can be done in many ways, making them understand the need for responsiveness, letting a lot of them retire, curtailing it, about 23 million right now. Digitization. There was a revolutionary contract given for $80 million to an Indian company simply to digitize records so that human interaction is not necessary anymore. Revoking laws and practices which require human interaction and making it more and more e-governance oriented, which is happening in India too. And progressively increasing the share of merchandise export, which is only 0.7% and moving very, very slowly compared to 5.3% of China. One word about democracy. Now, people, I don't know whether they're still saying it, but they used to regard democracy in some ways by implication as being a force which is pulling down growth. Well, political systems are not picked up a la carte. There are reasons why societies are like that. India's diversity and history and cultural characteristics are such that it can only have a government which rules by consent of the governed. Any other system in India is not possible. It's not that India is moving slowly per se and something can be done to dramatically increase it. Many things can be done, as I have mentioned, but it's important to understand that a democratic model in the stage in which India is also intrinsically a slower moving model. But then at the same time, one must not lose sight of the fact that the gains of democracy far outweigh any other statistical consideration. Because a society like India, a billion people, with 16 official languages, divided in any number of states, which requires not only the participation of the individuals, but requires the participation of the state itself, can only move with the system with the universal ownership of policy. And what was thought earlier as being possibly a democratic deficit, in my view, has turned out to be a democratic dividend. Because the fact that there is turnover of power, turnover of political parties, there's hardly any party you can think of which has not been in power or which is not in power currently in India, requires everyone to create middle ground of what your social, political, and economic policy is. And therefore, ironically, whereas the political actors keep on changing, what the political actors are trying to achieve solidifies itself and grows deeper and deeper roots. It is for this reason that I believe that as far as the important aspect of coherence is concerned, you will find that India is moving in a mature and a progressive way in having a coherence interface between its economy, its social policy, and its political institutions. Lastly, Mr. Chairman, what are then the principal characteristics I want to mention at the end? Firstly, I'd say that it's not an accomplishment which is reaching any kind of maturity. I mean, that's the remarkable thing about what's happening in India. All the areas which I had mentioned are really areas in which we are getting started. Yeah, they're not areas in which we are maturing. Basically, if you look at our potential, what you've done in trade, in agriculture, in manufacture, services, and the knowledge economy is just being taken off from the starting block. So a lot of the action is now to come. Demography is in your favor because 55% to 60% of your population is below the age of 25. And I have some quotations here of what kind of India they would like to see. And they are now becoming a driving force into what the political culture requires to do. So it is not a maturing performance. It is a starting performance, despite the fact that it's an ancient civilization. Second is that the drive and momentum is autonomous. This is an extremely important point, in my view, to register. I spoke about the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution started because of the humiliation of needing in the 60s to negotiate ship by ship, shiploads of wheat from the United States to fend off starvation. And the Prime Minister of the day said, got their team together of bureaucrats and experts in agricultural universities. And he says, do what you like, but we've got to feed ourselves. Give it what it takes. But this is a top priority. And we achieved it, as we did in milk and other areas too. When the 1990s reform started, it is useful to recall that it was because of a huge balance of payment crisis in which we even had to hypothecate our gold, and it was an external stimulus which said something is not right with your policy if this is where you've ended up. And in fact, our Prime Minister is associated from the very beginning. So that was also associated also with the collapse of that great socialist framework, which in some way, starting from the 1930s, in the West as well, was taken very seriously, which was the Soviet socialist framework. Much of the intellectual protection laws, which we are now applying in pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceutical industry in India was, in the beginning, very, very resistant. It was really, you know, sometimes like a gunfight at OK Corral in Geneva between the pharmaceutical industry of the West, particularly US and the Indians. But the dynamics of the Uruguay trade round required of us to have a balance where you had to make concessions. So we said, all right, this was 88, 89, let's give ourselves 15 years in order to give process patents rather than to give product patents rather than process patents. But at that point of time, we thought that we had made a concession, but not anymore. But now, whatever reform impulse we have is because we feel like winners, we want to integrate with the world economy, we want to be players in the world economy, we want to get away from all that has held us back, and we want to, in lessons learned, we want to emulate the best and not have a huge superstructure of excuses of why we should not be among the best. So the drive is now completely autonomous. The third important point, extremely important, is the fundamentals are sustainable. And when you look at sustainability, you're not talking only about economic fundamentals. There's a great revolution in India. It was a stratified society. For centuries, people were condemned to menial tasks with no political empowerment, with no social empowerment. And since independence, over half a century, this also had to be turned around in the biggest affirmative program, in my view, social program in history. This work is still in progress. Everything India is doing is work in progress. But the fundamentals, which are social, which are political, because of democracy and the respect for freedoms, and which are economic, are very sustainable and are very strong. And lastly, revolution in mindset. This is something which everyone has observed, including myself. Many people who've dealt with India and Indians for so long say, what kind of talk is this? You never heard it. You don't meet anyone in India who's not optimistic, who doesn't feel they can overcome all the problems, who don't believe they have the managerial and any other capacity which may be required to meet their peers on equal terms. And once again, when I was reading the Morgan Stanley report, among the precise factors which are working for India, it used the term resurgence in ambition levels. I thought it was very perceptive and rather well put. Resurgence in ambition levels. Because unless you are ambitious about yourself, you really cannot be an achiever and a winner. Thank you very much. I'm at the mercy of the audience now.
Would you like to...
There? Okay. Yes. I could do with some water, right?
So there is a traveling mic, and His Excellency will be very happy to answer your questions.
Thank you. Very exciting prospects, of course. Two questions, please. You know, very impressively, if I may put it, you didn't mention anything about population growth, population problems. Is it no longer a problem because of the fact that the economy is now so much taking off the traction, so to speak? And may I ask you also, would you like to single out something unique that India presents to the globalizing world? You know, is there a particularly outstanding kind of quality or contribution that India could make, is making or could make? Thank you.
Yeah, well, the first question is very interesting. You know, there's been just as you have the magnetic field of the Earth changing from north to south, something similar seems to be happening on the population issue. Because for decades we had heard that this population of unbounding increase and explosion in the population of youth of the country is going to pull down the country. And now people are saying the same factor is now an asset in the country because the aging dependence ratio, I think that's the term, from which the rest of the world is apparently being afflicted, including apparently a few years down the road, China itself, mm-hmm. which policy they could reverse. In the case of India, it's not the case because of the point I mentioned. The age group, which is the majority age group, is the age group only coming into the field of employment. This can be an asset only if they have jobs. It cannot be an asset if they don't have jobs. Which is why when you talk about services in India, in terms of job creation, that's not the answer. There are 800,000 IT professionals in India. And I'm told by the year 2008, you need 2 million. That's not the solution to the employment problem. It has to be manufacturing and it has to be agriculture, which is why they have to really pay attention and not be swept away by all this kind of high-tech talk. As far as the rate of growth of population is concerned, it is declining steadily. It was 3.4% at independence. It has now come to between 1.8 and 1.9. The sustainable rate is about 1.1, 1.2. So it is coming down progressively. But it will come down as the country becomes richer. It is very important to have this growth rate, not only because you become rich, but because then the stabilization rate of your population is achieved quicker. So people are a little bit more relaxed, not sanguine, a little bit more relaxed on the population issue. As to any intrinsic worth of Indians, my feeling is it has to be in their capacity for lateral thinking, some form or the other. This is a point many people have made. One investor said, you know, it's very irritating, actually, many times, because instead of minding their own business, and so many of your employees come and ask me all kinds of questions and raise issues and none of their business, really, but they are interested in other aspects of the business too, of why it can't be done a little bit differently. In this model which I mentioned, the comprehensive maturity model, this was something I found on the net also. This was a very sophisticated exercise undertaken by, I think, the University of Stanford, but I may be wrong, of why is it that India has moved away from the sweatshop paradigm into a high delivery and productivity paradigm. And they found something interesting. They found that the ability to distill a lesson from a piece of assignment you have just completed was not unique, but one of the strong features of Indian companies, which meant that as they went along, the error quotient, which may have been 0.2 something, the number of digits in the error quotient keeps on getting larger and larger till it becomes astronomical, because they can distill from what they are doing how they can do something else better. I don't know whether one believes in intrinsic capability, but many people have said that maybe there's a kind of a DNA which comes from the kind of culture India was. For many centuries it was an oral and an auditory culture. You needed to keep everything inside your head. It was not a referral culture. And our traditions of learning and of transmitting learning is of a master sitting there with everything basically inside the head, not with huge tomes, although they produced huge long tomes as well. And somebody today, last month, when I met them, they said that actually he speaks on the Indian theory of knowledge. And he says this ability to hold a lot of information at one time also gives them the ability to connect more than is otherwise possible. And this makes the lateral capacity to think also greater. I don't know whether all of this is really hot air or makes any sense or not. But one thing is certain, the kind of capacity Indians have suddenly demonstrated ties up with something. Some kind of a cultural aptitude, and this could be linked with the fact that you were in numeracy and so on. In intellectual capital, as I said, you were always a very advanced culture. Recently I spoke before the Prime Minister was good enough to give to speak on India at a lunch, and I spoke of 5 minutes before that, and I did make the point that India has been regarded for so long as a developing country. But it is worth recalling that in intellectual capital, it has never been a developing country.
Thank you very much, Your Excellency. My name is Asif. I am a freelance journalist. One thing that come out of your speech is India is opening. And I think the mention of Bollywood, that it is making the boundaries and the borders beyond the world. My question pertaining to India's relationship to the neighbors, like in order to attract the investors from outside the world, wherever and whichever the Western economies have emerged into the global players, they have developed a relationship within their neighborhood. India and Pakistan, progressive talks, giving good indications to the world, especially to the investors, those who are coming. I would like to mention your attention towards that, like the peace talks progressing towards it, and there are still, India is proficient in software engineering and plus in media and also drama and film, theater, they are very proficient. We can attract the students from the world, especially from Pakistan, and also invite the families with the blood relations across the border. What are the government thinking about of relaxing the ties in order to make the people move freely? to build up the economy.
Well, the government is certainly thinking along these lines, but what the people are thinking is absolutely clear. And the recent interactions on both sides have made it has demonstrated that people want to close the past chapter. And they want a chapter of partnership and of peace. One recent lesson, an important one, which I think both with the countries of South Asia have to learn and are learning, is that in the modern world, there's no such thing, even if you believe that there can be, there's no such thing really as a country doing extremely well but the region doing badly. That doesn't happen. Even an economy like the American economy is now striving for the economic space of the Americas. The first lesson here was from Europe. The first half of last century, Europe demonstrated how not to do things collectively. In the second half of the century, it showed how to do it. The whole experiment began with a very innocuous and pedestrian sounding body called the Steel and Coal Community of Europe. And now people are about to take a referendum on the constitution of Europe. In our part of the world, ASEAN demonstrated it. Of course, now we're in probably the ASEAN maturity model. you're starting to have a little bit, but you know, in the earlier decades, it did brilliantly. And the demonstration was either sink your differences or the differences will sink you. This is a pretty much a universal lesson. In other areas of the world, like Mercosur, where there was, you know, push and pull always between Argentina and Brazil, same lesson was learned. Uruguay, Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina formed the Mercosur, and now it's been extending, and that showed dramatic results as well. In its own way, even in South Africa, looking at the stage of economies, there are only positive things which these associations have shown. Therefore, you need to follow a policy of prosper thy neighbor and not beggar thy neighbor. You cannot advance your national interest on a policy of schadenfreude and deriving pleasure from the discomfiture of your neighbor. That's an impossibility. Because sooner or later, the negativism will be visited upon you. My own feeling is that that the South Asian region has very clearly understood this. At the time of partition, there was a division of United India. There was a political division, there was an economic division, there was a cultural division between people to people, all kinds of division. The sentiment on both sides is very clear now. Political division is a fact of history. Not only will it not be changed, there is no desire on the part of anyone to change it. And what the leaders are saying is, why is it necessary even to have this kind of talk? Because borders are becoming less important all the world over. So why should we be fixated on the borders? But the other kinds of divisions, which are cultural, social, economic, we have to re-knit them. And we have to get the synergy of partnership of people of one region, which is a win-win game for both sides. In United India, nobody used to suggest that the part of India, which is now India today, and the part which was Pakistan, was somehow very differentiated in the attributes. In fact, West Punjab and the educational institutions they had, the Government College Lahore was considered the Oxford of India, Allahabad was considered the Cambridge of India. Everyone thought of human capability in the same terms. And I think the big revolution that is taking place is that all the human beings of that region want to recover their human potential.
Thank you. Here.
High Commissioner, on the subject of population, once again, a recent research study shows that India's population will increase by as much as 600 million in the next 25 years. And the bulk of that population increase will occur in the northern states of Bihar, Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, and so on, you know. while the south, you see, has fairly contained its population increase. So there is a certain imbalance already emerging, you know, between the North and the South. Now, aggravating that situation, as it were, is the fact that the parliamentary representation has been frozen in 1977 on the 1971 census levels. So this is adding to the social tensions and so on. So would you say that there is a room for concern here?
There's no doubt that there is regional imbalance, which is arising. The growth rate is declining everywhere, but is declining much faster, as you said, in many of the states in the South. In fact, in three states, in Kerala, Pondicherry, Tamil Nadu, you have replacement levels now already. We were talking about a divide also of an economic nature, which is North-South and East-West. But I think as far as the economic divide is concerned, I am hopeful that the rate of growth is going to pick up. And the rate of growth is going to make a difference to the population growth rate as well. We cannot extrapolate with any degree of certitude what's going to happen 20 years from now, or 25 years from now, a quarter century later. If you were to sit in 1975 and wonder what 2000 would be like, I wonder how many items you'd get right. Say, sitting in 1900, 1925, 25 to 50, 50 to 75, dramatic things happen within human society. Many of the changes that are working are subterranean, which are not visible. You can only take into account that which is before your eyes. And my own feeling is that when all of these factors start working, you will probably find that the extrapolation in population you were making now has been a bit off the mark. There's no doubt that the population is going to increase. But there's no reason to believe that it's going to stabilize at as high a level as people believe will be the case 25 years before the anticipated event.
Thank you. At the back there.
His Excellency, I want to ask you about democracy. You've obviously talked about democracy as being an advantage for India, and as coming up, helping in coming to a consensus. But can you also talk to us about the problems that the Indian democratic system faces and the problems that it's going through and the things that are wrong with Indian democracy? And what can we do to address those problems?
Well, as somebody said, I think, was it D.M. Foster? He wrote an essay in which he said, Winston Churchill said, firstly, that in a choice of all bad systems, this is the best bad system, democracy. The other system is much more awful, according to him. And I think E.M. Forster said, we can't raise three cheers for democracy, but let's at least raise two cheers for democracy. In human life, you know, nothing comes unadulterated. You have to, life is a trade-off. And I think the trade-off in a democratic system is hugely in favor of the credit side rather than the debit side. Because you can only judge even the negative side of democracy with an alternative system. You cannot say that, look, let's have democracy, but somehow get rid of the negative side of it. That's not possible. It is a package. It comes as a package. But now that you ask me a specific question, obviously, the actors in the democratic system have to understand that what drives democracy is not the structure, but the spirit. Because in all post-colonial setups, a basically democratic structure was left behind. And what happened? I don't think the right spirit was pursued or imbued was injected within the system. This means, in my view, A, you cannot be power hungry to a point that when the democratic culture wishes you to leave, you must feel that you have to hang on. I think it's been dramatically demonstrated in positive terms in the last elections when we moved from a paper election to a paper-free election, electronic. In 5 years, it was really something extraordinary. And since we didn't want to make any exceptions, you had elephants in your mountainous regions, And you had pictures of this electronic machine being carried up. It would have been easier simply to say, why don't you have it in paper? But people said, no, you must have coherence, and you must have the same system everywhere. So we managed to do it. But when the results were announced, the Prime Minister of the day did not say, I don't trust the system, as has happened in other parts of the world. I want to look into the machines. I think the machines are doctored, or whatever. Whatever reservations he may have had, he said the verdict is there. The verdict is a national one. Mm. The verdict is clear. Mm. I am stepping down. By this afternoon, I will be a caretaker Prime Minister. Now that is going by the spirit. But if you are wanted in a court of law, if you are facing corruption charges, if you're not living up to the ideals of a democratic state, then I think it is incumbent upon you as a person to stay. I don't want to hold a formal position. It is things of this nature, which is to say self-regulation of individual actors in the democratic field. Because mind you, what we thought would be negatives have not turned out to be negatives. For instance, coalition government, we thought it will be total chaos. We'll never get anywhere. We'll just have a chaos in every legislature in India. It has happened like that. Then we said, what happens when the great parties like the Congress Party collapse and we'll have a proliferation of parties? Well, you had regional parties, but the regional parties, as it were, gave themselves a national dimension. And the national parties, because they became smaller, like the Congress, had to give themselves a regional dimension. So the culture becomes more complex and more responsive on both ends. But I do feel that in the end, it is a question of having a personal code of conduct among the individual actors, which is ironclad. Another very helpful thing in democracy is, people said, it will all be manipulated from the top. With the Panchayati Raj experience, we have 3 million elected representatives in India. 1 million because of 30% reservation of women. More women are being elected at the town and village levels than the quota itself. Because people feel that women are real about problems on the ground and solutions. So democracy is taking place and thriving in India at all the three levels, which is national, state, and the ground level. But I think we have a long way to go in order to have a code of conduct and honor internalized among all the actors. But it's not a bad record overall.
Right, I was going to abuse my position and ask a question myself, but I'll let you go first.
Just a quick follow-on to the prior question. Do you think the federal structure of Indian government right now is a plus or a minus for growth?
It's a plus, because I think by and large over the last 50 years, what you see in India as evolving politically is a stable and a mature model. There was a huge debate actually in 1956, I think, when our first Prime Minister steered a very important political decision to have the states configured according to regional languages. And people said, you're now going to have a Babel in India. And you won't have a national language. People won't need to have a national language. Regional nationalism is going to grow. And many people, the elite view, at that time I recall, I was an adolescent, seemed to be, that's not a smart move. Finally, from the very beginning, I thought it was a very smart move. Because the biggest failure, if you look at a failed state and you start deconstructing the reason why it got there, you will see somewhere a failure to manage group grievances. In the first instance, they should never have been allowed to rise. And my own feeling is, if you have language groups, the Tamil as a language is older than Sanskrit, or at least as old as Sanskrit, which is said by many to be the oldest continuous language in the world. How can you not say that Tamilians should use and speak their own language? You have 16 languages, the scripts are different. the histories are different. It's like denying, if you are a united Europe, denying a united Europe, that the Greeks want their language, so do the Spaniards and the Italians and the French and the Germans. Where India is a union of states, but in its variety it is no different from Europe. So I think it was really a very enlightened move to concede the point that it can only be on the basis of acknowledged variety that unity can be strengthened, not on the basis of spurious imposed unity. When people are comfortable within their own regional identity, and which is why in our constitution we have three lists. We have the central list of finance, security, very important areas. They are national lists, and then you have regional lists like education, you know, and police and so on. You have overlapping lists as well, because obviously, you know, your decision in one level impinges on the other. But this decision was taken in languages as well as what you can do for yourself. It also increased the sense of responsibility, and the people needed to go and elect their own regional leaders as well. So I think the federal model is a very, very strong model for India.
I'm not going to get my own question in. One and two.
Your Excellency, recently the US Congress said that, you know, India, obviously, that they had a motion that it had the best IT technology, and they were quite favorable to it, just to add to your point. But further on the G8 issue, what further benefits will India have, in your mind, by partaking with the G8, and where can they really benefit the best?
Well, I think at one level, your question reminds me of the crack by Groucho Marx. You know. Groucho Marx said, you know, I don't want to be a member of a club which feels that they can invite me to become a member. But the reverse is also true. You know, when an exclusive club, anyone wants to invite you, you know, you have to have very strong reasons to say, no, I don't think I want to join you. They obviously see something why they want to have you. Now, if India believes, as it does, that in the time to come it's going to be a global player in investment transactions and currency transactions, in trade, in the intellectual capital of the world, in the global division of labor which is now upon us. Very interesting article, I don't know whether it ever came out, by Paul Samuelson. He's 90 plus, but he bestirred himself to write an article, and since we're sitting in the LSE, maybe you can tell me, whether it came out in the Journal of Economic Perspectives. I saw it on the internet when the debate had already started. And Samuelson said that, look, I'm a free trader and the strongest free trader since Adam Smith, but I made an error and I want to acknowledge this. And this is that I thought that the world economy is going to move because the North is going to keep on vacating areas which the South will fill. And basically this is going to be the North-South paradigm. And this did happen. And if you look at steel and shipbuilding and many of these, you know, it was happening. The high value will keep on moving in the north, and the south will keep on moving up, but probably just a little below second tier. He says, no, this is wrong, because what the south is now beginning to say is, thank you very much, we will accept the areas being vacated by you, but we'll now also challenge you at the upper end. So the global paradigm, which is based on knowledge as a resource and intellectual capital as a resource, cannot do without a country which is going to have this resource in plenty. And if your reserves are going up, so they're already 140, India is already in the first, I think, four or five countries which have these reserves. So whether you're looking at trade potential or currency policy or global economic policy, I think India progressively is going to be a player. Now, if you want to have a say in global consideration of all of these issues, then if someone invites you to join that gremium where this discussion takes place, why should you say no? It doesn't make any sense. I think what's going to happen is what happened with Russia earlier, which is India and China are going to be invited to participate on these occasions, and in course of time they'll probably become integral to the group.
Thank you. Here.
Your Excellency, do you have any suggestions as to how India can maintain the fine lead she has in ICT, given this competition, stiff competition from China and Eastern European countries?
And there's no such thing as a permanent advantage. If you don't move up the value chain and delivery quality, then there's no such thing in the world as staying put, basically. You might think you're staying put. You're either moving forward or you're moving backward. There's always momentum. There's no such thing as being static. That's always an illusion. And if you think you're static, you're doing very well because you've got these wonderful call centers and others, well, the others will come up and duplicate. You now, the only trick is to keep on moving at a clip when this act of duplication becomes very difficult. And duplication will become difficult only if the qualities you're bringing forward, the value you're adding to the services you're rendering, is such that they become very, very specialized, and where you always have what I just now described as an India advantage. The India advantage is not a static advantage. It is a moving advantage. It will in the end always be a skill-related advantage and a cerebral capacity-related advantage. And I think this is an advantage you can keep on building on, because sky is the limit for movement in this direction.
Last question from here.
Thank you, Your Excellency and Professor Harrison. I'm a Chinese visiting professor at Asia Research Center. I'd like to ask questions about your respective your opinion on China's rise and India-China relations. With the recent development of China's economy, so you can follow the, in the international community have some discuss about China's rise of future, its impact on the international relations. Some other countries such as the United States, they some might say it's an opportunity for Chinese rise, or some might say it's a threat, or it's a rival, either a partnership or rival, or cooperator or competitor. I want to know what you think of the, what your comment on what you think of China rise. Does China can rise peacefully as it proclaimed? Or if China rise, what do you think of its impact on the India-China relations, or the Asia, or the, largely on the international relations, things, you know, two countries are main actors and players in the Asia or in the world under? Thank you.
Well, the answer to your question is very simple. What is better, a rising China or a declining China? I mean, that's a question you can ask any society. Which society is better, a rising one or a declining one? I can never understand the question why the rise, or the particularly the economic rise, of any society is threatening. Because it increases the pie, it prevents the sentiment that, you know, the world is a zero-sum game. Someone's rise means someone else's decline. It's not like that. People can do better and rise everywhere. As far as India is concerned, the rise of China has had a very, very important impact. Because in the mind of Indians, you could always have explained away things. After the war, Japan was in very bad shape, did extremely well. But you know, Japan was really already industrial power. After 1868, with the Meiji Revolution, it just had to recover what it already was. Then we saw the rise of Korea. And as you know, it was a very special case because there's an affiliation and a lot of security and economic ties with the West, which made this possible. Very, you know, progressively, we found that people do well because they follow smart policies, because they invest in the human capital, because they have a realistic appreciation of how the world is headed and what to do with it. And once China started doing well, then of course that was the ultimate demonstration of the fact that even a huge society, and the only society which matches India in size is the Chinese society, can do well. So as a model, there's nothing like the advance of China for Indians, because in their mind, the Indians say, look, if the Chinese can do it, then let's just drop all excuses and get going with it. The second is the interaction bilaterally. India and China did a very smart thing, which is now also happening, in my view, with India and Pakistan, which is that if we have a problem, let us not allow the problem to cast a shadow on everything positive that can happen between us. So we decided that we've had a border issue between us, but let it not cast a shadow over the overall relationship. And both of us said, we'll put it aside, we'll keep on talking about it. The time will come when a solution will be found, but let's move ahead with the rest. And what happens is, if the rest moves ahead and you have a benign relationship, then it starts impacting positively on that problem, the size of which then shrinks. It suddenly becomes manageable, doable, and solvable. But if you go the other direction, the size of the problem inflates. Nobody knows where to start it and how it's all going to end up. So the rise of China has also had that benefit, because we said, at least let us be partners in co-prosperity and not allow this problem to pull us down. One dramatic example of this is, our trade was 1 billion 4 years ago, a year. Now it is more than 1 billion a month already. It is very important for India and China to be partners and to exhibit a relationship based on trust, because it's a very old and ancient relationship which has been based on trust. And it goes back thousands and thousands of years. One or two examples which I like to give, which are very interesting, is that the word, India is known for tea, is the primary producer of tea, but the Indian word for tea, which is chai, is actually a Chinese word. The word Mandarin is associated only with China and the courtiers and the court. The word Mandarin in its root is an Indian word. China brought to the world the movable types, I think it was the 7th century, and revolutionized printing, although it took a long time to come to Europe. But the first book which was printed through movable types was a scripture from India. It is the famous Diamond Sutra of the Buddhist. It was honored by being the first book as the in which the wisdom was appreciated in China, which had come from India. You'll wonder, well, look, if it was in Pali or Sanskrit, how was it published? In Chinese. Because an Indian scholar came to China and translated it from Sanskrit into Chinese. So this kind of a respect and interaction goes very, very deep between the Indian and Chinese societies. And I think it is very important when we talk about global governance and the values that should govern our global governance, it is extremely important for China and India to show by example of a relationship which, despite its huge magnitude, is only a power of good to each other, for the region, and to the world.
Sir, I think that those last remarks do actually make a very fitting sort of final point of tonight's discussion. I think that the questions that you have had from the audience here shows how very much how your remarks have stimulated us, and we're very grateful to you indeed for giving your time to come to be with us this evening, and for answering so many questions in such a very interesting way.
I can't let you go without your asking your question. You had a question, which is hijacked.
I will have the opportunity to ask you my question later. I think I should I should let the session now.
I want to thank the audience for coming. I know, you know, it's a very competitive environment here, and that all of you thought it was worthwhile coming here is very, very flattering to me. And I hope it has been sort of mildly rewarding for you.
Thank you very much.